Ah, rhythm. There, we got it up to the rhythm. And now, Ruth Williams, maybe you might have a little something to say in this rhythm.
There's just one fellow for me in this world.
Harry's his name.
That's what I claim.
For every fellow, there must be a girl. Then you're just wild about Harry.
And Harry's wild about me.
The heavenly blisses of his kisses
fill me with ecstasy.
He's sweet just like chocolate candy.
And just like honey from a bee.
And you're just wild about Harry.
And he's just wild about
me. Can I do without
Harry? Wild about me.
Welcome to the Broadway Radio Show. I'm Donald Feltham, and I have Cassine Gaines with me. Hi, Cassine.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very good. And you are here because your book, When Broadway Was Black, is coming out this week. It will be in stores and available on February 7th. You also, as we are going to talk about a little bit later, you're also going to be at the Museum of Broadway on February 8th doing a book signing. So if people are in New York, you can see him at the Museum of Broadway, which I was visiting in November, and I went to the Museum of Broadway right like the week it opened.
Wow.
And it's a fantastic. I was very impressed. I thought they did a really, really good job. So, and I like that they have been making a real effort to bring in people like you, like authors, to do book signings and feature current Broadway shows and having the cast come in. And so they're really, really making themselves a part of the Broadway community. So I was thrilled to hear that you're going to be there. So congrats on that.
Thank you.
Just to get one little piece of business out of the way so people understand, the book, even though it's entitled When Broadway Was Black, was originally published in 2021 as Footnotes, The Black Artists Who Rewrote the Rules of the Great White Way, but has been retitled for, I'm assuming it's retitled for the paperback edition. Is that the way this is working?
That's right. And actually, it's sort of, I refer to this as like the special edition of Footnotes. When we were going back into the paperback, we just felt like there was an opportunity to add. One of the things that I wanted to do with the book was not just have it be a history piece, but also have it be a part of an ongoing conversation about mm-hmm. racial representation in theater. And so much had changed since 2021. When I wrote the hardcover version of the book, Broadway was still shut down completely, actually. So it just seemed like there was an opportunity to add. And so there's a new introduction. The last chapter is almost completely rewritten. And there's lots of little differences throughout. If you're a really careful reader and you've read Footnotes already, you'll see quite a bit more in this edition and some new photos as well. So it's very similar to Footnotes, but like I said, there's a little bit of Botox.
Right. And, you know, since I want listeners to purchase the book, because it is a wonderful read, we're only going to scratch the surface of what you cover, because we want them to just kind of get a little sample of some of the topics here. I mean, the main focus, obviously, is on the musical shuffle along, because the kind of the subtitle of the book is The Triumphant Story of the All Black Musical That Changed the World. But there are a lot of different areas that you go into that are not specifically just about Shuffle Along, which is what I really loved about the book. And it's don't be daunted when you get your copy. I was shocked when I opened the envelope. I got to be honest with you, when the publicist sent me the book, you came in just under the wire because I needed to get it before I was leaving the country because I was heading to Egypt for 2 weeks, and I got a notification from FedEx saying the book was actually arriving the day I was leaving. So I was like, well, I'm leaving the house at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, so I hope it gets here before then. But it showed up the day before, so it was perfect timing. And then when I pulled it out of the envelope, it's a thick book. I mean, I was like, oh my God, this book is a lot longer than I thought it was going to be. But it's not that thick. It's actually about 400 pages. The rest of it is sort of reading guide and acknowledgments and a fantastic index. But I have to tell you, I really had a hard time putting the book down. I read it at every opportunity I had while I was traveling. And it's a fascinating, fascinating read. And tell the listeners, what drew you to actually write the book?
So I actually saw the 98th performance of George C. Wolfe's Shuffle Along, or the making of the musical sensation of 1921 and all that followed. And even though it was the 98th performance, it closed at 100 performances, it was the day before it closed. Mm-hmm. And so I was so struck by so much in the theater that day. First, I was struck by the show itself and how colorful and vibrant and fun it was. And when they got to the number, I'm Just Wild About Harry, I was sort of surprised because I was so incredibly familiar with that song, and yet I wasn't familiar with Shuffle Along in that way. Mm-hmm. I certainly did not associate I'm Just Wild About Harry as being a song written by Black composers from an all-Black musical from 1921. So the thing that kind of stuck with me most was, after the performance, I had the opportunity to be in the audience for a kind of intimate, very intimate talk back. And I believe it was Brian Stokes Mitchell who was on stage talking about how hard it was to do this show at this point, because the show was closing prematurely and everyone was so excited to be working on this piece of theater that was meant to celebrate and sort of uplift this piece of theater from almost a century earlier. And yet now the show was closing with kind of little fanfare. It was nominated for 10 Tony Awards, lost every single one to Hamilton.
Right. It was the season of Hamilton, unfortunately.
It was the season of Hamilton. Right. And it was a fantastic season on Broadway. You know, it's a great season besides Hamilton, or in addition to Hamilton, I should say. And I think it's such a funny detail, but it's in the book. I think the thing that sort of like stuck with me also was there was like nothing left in the merchandise kiosks, you know, like it was just sort of like you felt like this show had already left, even though they still had two more performances. And when I got back home, I started looking into Shuffle Along a little bit more. And I think what really got me was learning that Langston Hughes single-handedly credited this show with kickstarting the Harlem Renaissance. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just a significant piece of theater for the Broadway community, but it was a significant piece of theater for modern entertainment. Mm-hmm. And once I started thinking about it through that lens, it really caused me to say, my goodness, you know, as a writer, there's so much that you can do in 400 pages of a book that perhaps you can't do in a 2.5 hour Broadway musical that that has the same goal, but just the medium is different. And as I started exploring this story, it seemed like the more I learned, the more I realized, my goodness, Shuffle Along is the nucleus of this story, but there is such a greater story to tell about Broadway and New York and race and America and the way in which we view art, even mm-hmm. still today. And so the book certainly morphed and changed and adapted. You know, we've talked a little bit about the size of the book, and I have to say, I blew past my word count, and I had an editor who, you know, thankfully said, I don't even know what I would recommend that you cut. And so we made some very minor edits. I think maybe we lost about maybe 10 or 15 pages from what I had originally submitted. But it's just a wonderful story, I think, for everyone who loves theater and loves Shuffle Along. And even people who don't know Shuffle Along, I think everyone would be in for a treat.
Yeah, I agree. It's more than just, it's a wonderful book for anybody who's a fan of Broadway and American theater, and gives you a lot of real perspective on where theater was at that period in time in the early 20th century. But it's also a historical document because it really spans a lot more than just that. I mean, Shuffle Along, the show, doesn't show up until I think it's like almost 125 pages into the book, because the first quarter of the book is spent kind of introducing us to the characters who are going to play a major role, not only in the show, but are going to play a major role in just the whole world of Black entertainment in America at that point. Because you talk a lot about the four men who basically became the creators of the show. We're talking about Blake, and there were actually kind of two teams. There was Blake and Sissel, who were the songwriting team, and then you had Miller and Lyles, who were sort of the book mm-hmm. performer team. And you go into the background of all of them, which I found really fascinating, because how they came together and the different things that they were involved in and how they meshed together and how they all met. But you also talk a lot about someone that I did not know anything about, and that is James Rhys Europe, who I found an absolutely amazing character. So talk mm-hmm. a little bit about who he was and how influential he was.
I love that. Because, you know, to me, James Rhys Europe is the fifth main character of this
yeah.
book.
You
know, he's in it just for a brief period of time. And, you know, James Rhys Europe was a band leader. He was a World War I lieutenant. He was, I think it's fair to say, almost like a union organizer, you know, mm-hmm. Without the formal title. He was a real advocate. UB Blake described him as the Martin Luther King Jr. of music before Martin Luther King Jr. came to be. And what I love about him is he is someone who believed so much in the power of dignity in Black art. Mm-hmm. He gathered a bunch of Black musicians in New York City and made sure that when they were playing public events or concerts or even at Carnegie Hall, which he, you know, did, that they were paid fair wages, that they had proper accommodations, that they were fed, they were treated with dignity. Performers always wore tuxedos when they worked with him. And he also believed that Black art would succeed best in this country if African Americans embraced their culture through mm-hmm. their art. If they did not try to assimilate to the conventions of white operatic styles or European styles, but instead embraced really what made their music and their artistry unique. James Rhys Europe is credited in large part with bringing jazz to Paris as a part of the 369th Infantry Regiment Band. And so he was really fantastic. And he was someone who had this longstanding dream of having an all-Black symphony orchestra that would sort of rival the all-white symphony orchestras in New York. And unfortunately, he did not live long enough to see that come to pass. But what ended up happening was he was sort of, in an odd way, the connective tissue between those two pairs that you were talking about. Mm-hmm. Cecil Blake worked with him very closely. Cecil actually served with him, you know, in the army. And Miller and Lyles actually had done a show with him a couple of years earlier. So they were all in the same circles. And in a way, his premature death kind of served as a catalyst for both teams to shoot for the stars. Mm-hmm. And it led them in a strange way to partnering up on what ultimately became Shuffle Along.
What's the time? Nine, all in line. All right, boys, now take it slow. Are you ready? Eddie, very good, Eddie. Over the top, let's go. Quiet, quiet, else it's caught a riot. Keep to proper distance, follow along. Hover, mother, and when you see me hover, obey my orders and you won't go wrong. There's a minute bus a coming, look out. Hear that roar, there's one more. Stand fast, for there's a very light. Don't gasp for the fine, you all right. Don't start the bumming with those hand grenades. There's a machine gun, the holy space. Alert, gas, put on your mask. Adjust it correctly and hurry up fast. Drop, there's a rocket for the fight barrage. Down, hug the ground, close your can, don't stand. Creep and crawl, follow me, that's all. What do you hear? Nothing near, don't fear, all clear. That's the life of a soul when you take a patrol. Out in no man's land, ain't it grand? Out in no man's land. There's a million buffer coming, look out! Hear that roar, there's one more. And fast, there's a very light. Don't gasp for the fine, you're all right. Don't start the bumming with those hand grenades. And machine gun, the holy space. Alert, gas, put on your mask. Adjust it correctly and hurry up fast. Drop, there's a rocket for the Bosch barrage. Down, hug the ground, close you can, don't stand. Creep and crawl, or follow me, that's all.
The boys! Go do it!
Hey! Get the bloody boys! Get them! Stick them with the bayonets on the ramaton!
Come on!
What do you hear? Nothing near, don't fear, all clear. That's the life of a soul when you take a patrol. Out in no man's land, ain't it grand? Out in no man's land.
I think that's exactly what I took from it, which was his kind of belief that there were no real boundaries, mm-hmm. and there should not be any roadblocks to Black artists, kind of inspired the two different teams when they were working on Shuffle Along and or the concept of doing a show together, that there was nothing outlandish or unreasonable about them saying, well, we're going to do a Broadway show. You know, which was just did not happen up until then. But the feeling that he had, which was there's no reason to say you can't do something. You just do it. And I really loved that about the obvious influence he had on these guys. And talk about the two different teams, because they were very different. I mean, Blake and Cecil were two very different people. Just the two of them were very different from each other. And it's amazing that they even came together. And then we'll talk a little bit about Miller and Lyles, because I really want to get into the style of comedy they were doing, which to modern readers might be kind of head scratching, because you're like, really? They really were doing that kind of comedy and okay with it. So right. Talk a little about the two different teams and how they all came together.
It was important for me to kind of make sure that this book read, you know, my goal was for it to read as entertaining as possible. And so I thought the best way to kind of start was by just meeting the fellas, you know, as mm-hmm. you said, you know. And so UB Blake is such an interesting character because of the four of them, he's most likely to be the one that most people know.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. He lived such a long life and was such a wonderfully charismatic character in real life, and just, you know, incredibly talented and dexterous and beautiful pianist and composer, who never lost it, truly never lost it until like mm-hmm. his dying day. But what I love about UB Blake and Noble Sissel is that they were kind of the odd couple. UB Blake was not very educated. He was expelled from school very early on. Noble Sissel was college educated and made sure everyone knew it. It was obvious he wore it on his sleeve, his mm-hmm. education. UB was not, you know, formally trained. He cut his teeth playing in bordellos when he mm-hmm. was, you know, he was on the road. He joined up with a medicine show. You know, he was just sort of what I love about UB Blake in this book is that you really see that I think of the four of them, he just wanted to play. You know, like he would kind of play anywhere. And it wasn't even so much about the money. It was just in him. And you couldn't stop him from playing if there was a piano in front of him. That was just the kind of guy that he was. Meanwhile, Noble Sissel, what he sort of had was this kind of understanding of the way the quote unquote white world worked. You know, he was kind of fearless when it came to his ambition. He was definitely the more business oriented person of the two. And what the two of them knew was that they needed each other. That's what made mm-hmm. them such a great partnership. UB was a wonderful composer, but he was no lyricist. Noble Sissel, I think, is such a fantastic lyricist. I mean, if you listen to not just the music from Shuffle Along, but any of his songs, he just has this great witticism that, number one, is just so quintessentially musical theater, but also it's just clever. I mean, you can just tell that he's just a wonderful linguist. And so they were a wonderful pair. And actually their first, the first time they worked together, they sold a song to Sophie Tucker.
Right.
And in her show, you know, just a couple of days after meeting them, and they snuck their way backstage and got an audience with her. And, you know, the rest was sort of history. So they were kind of a fun pair. And I think when you talk about them in comparison with Miller and Lyles, Sissel and Blake also were of that James Reese Europe mindset where they always wore tuxedos. Mm-hmm. There was a kind of a famous incident where one of the promoters or booking agents rather at the Palace Theater didn't want to book them unless they would wear blackface.
Right.
And their manager just sort of said, like, well, if that's the case, then we'll go to the Schuberts, you know, and they mm-hmm. won't make them do it. And, you know, it's an odd thing, the concept of black performers in blackface, but even in that early portion of the 20th century, that was a kind of common convention, even in New York City. Mm-hmm. So, but they rejected that. And I think that's what's so interesting. And I guess the other thing that I want to mention about UB is that UB was a real lover of European operas. And so, you know, Shuffle Along is kind of a jazz score, but not entirely so. Some of it really is inspired by, you know, Victor Herbert and other composers that sound more like what musical theater sounded like before Shuffle Along.
Everybody thinks I'm crazy. They say I've gone some mad. Everybody thinks I'm crazy. Lost all the sense I ever had. But when they see me shake, it makes me shiver when I do a break. It makes me quiver, but I'm not insane. I'm not to blame. The cause of it all is not in my brain. Just because I like to do a wiggle in a regular Salome style. just because I like to do a wriggle like on a Hawaiian eye. Cause I kick like a donkey, jump way back, cause I act like a monkey and ball a jack. Then like Miss Minnie, I wanna shimmy, keep my shoulders shaking till you hear them crack. Just because you see my feet are shuffling, just because I act like a razz. Though I seem a little hazy, no, I ain't crazy, I'm just simply full of jazz, 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 jazz. I just simply full of jazz, jazz, jazz. Or oh, just because I like to do a wiggle in a regular snowman style. It's just because I like to do a wiggle like on a Hawaiian Isle. Because I kick like a donkey and I jump away back. Because I act like a monkey and I fall of the jack. And it's like Miss Minnie, I do the jimmy, keep my shoulders shaking till you hear them crack. Just because you like to do a wiggle, just because I act like a razz. Though it seem a little hazy, Lord, I ain't crazy, I just simply full of jazz. It makes you dippy, jazz is full of pep, jazz it makes you dippy, jazz it makes a preacher do a syncopated step, or jazz it makes you giggle, jazz it makes you shout, woo, jazz it makes you giggle, jazz it makes you say some things you shouldn't talk about, or jazz, 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 jazz. I just simply full of jazz, jazz, jazz. Just simply full of jazz, 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 jazz. I just simply full of jazz, jazz, jazz.
And talk about, because we were just discussing Black performers performing in blackface. So talk a little bit about Miller and Lyles, because I found them, I mean, I have obviously knew some stuff about UB Blake and Noble Sissle, but Miller and Lyles, I did not know that much about. And they embraced the blackface and embraced the kind of racial stereotypes in their comedy performances.
Yeah, and this is sort of an interesting thing, and I feel it was important for me to give a lot of space to Miller and Lyles, because I did know that they were the less known duo, mm-hmm. but also I think they're the less known duo, well, for a couple of reasons. Number one, I think, you know, pick a musical, any musical, I think the score always right. survives the book. But also, I think for a lot of people, Shuffle Along has this asterisk where, you know, there was blackface comedy in the mm-hmm. show. And that makes it a problematic thing to sort of grapple with. I had the good fortune of being able to spend a lot of time with Floyd Noe Miller's papers. There's a great collection of archival material at the Schomburg Center, and I was able to read letters. I was able to read portions of a unfinished and unpublished manuscript. And for Miller and Lyles, performing in blackface was really a means to an end. You know, it did not take long after white performers started performing in blackface in the United States before Black performers sort of got into the act as a way to gain entry into mm-hmm. what was previously all white spaces. And what's sort of remarkable is that they often made quite a bit of money doing it, because they would go to promoters and sort of say, like, look, if you're looking for someone to tap dance and tell certain jokes and put on a certain dialect, we can do it better than your white performers can.
Right.
And these Black performers actually, not Miller and Lyle specifically, but some actually posed as runaway slaves or the descendant, you know, the direct descendants of enslaved people. And, you know, was it demeaning? You know, sure. But I think it was also a way to earn a buck, mm-hmm. and also a way to actually get to perform,
right,
for captive audiences. And what I think is so interesting about Miller and Lyle specifically is a lot of their humor is actually, I think, very cleverly written. I think there's sort of this tendency to say, because someone is perhaps playing an ignorant character, perhaps they are ignorant themselves, or, you know, because someone, debases themselves in your view, that they had no self-worth or no self-value or something like that. And Miller and Lyles couldn't have been farther from that. They were both college educated. They both went to Fisk University. That's actually where they met. Mm-hmm. Incredibly skilled and talented people. And I think one of the saddest aspects of their story for me is that, you know, the two of them had this dream of owning and operating the first black-owned Broadway house. And they were getting financing together for it. And it had invested quite a bit of their own money. And Lyles dies prematurely. Mm-hmm. And not only does that dream not come to fruition, but it also puts Miller into incredible debt. He ends up filing for bankruptcy. And, when I think about how today, certainly not, well, there are no Black-owned theaters. You know, there's about six people that own almost all of the Broadway.
Right,
houses.
Exactly.
but the fact that at no point in time there has ever been a Black-owned Broadway house, and in 1933 it almost happened, it's kind of a sad missed opportunity. And I think that's one of the aspects that I think comes across in many aspects, many portions of this book as well, just sort of these near misses, mm-hmm. that perhaps could have even further changed the trajectory of history.
And as you said, even now the theaters are not owned by Black entrepreneurs, but in the early 20s, you know, there were talk about the roadblocks, because there were a lot of roadblocks to getting this show Shuffle Along to on stage in New York. I mean, you do have the involvement of John and Harry Court, which I think is really interesting. Obviously, people will know the name Court from the fact that there is a Court Theater still on Broadway. But talk about the problems of even just getting a theater, and how ultimately, I think one of the things I took away from it, I'm not sure whether this is what was intended in the book, but in a way, them not being able to get a traditional Broadway house to house the show ultimately benefited them, because it put them in a different theater, kind of off the beaten path for most Broadway audiences. So it made it an excursion, and you had to make an effort to go see the show. And they were working on such a slim budget that the kind of ragtag look to the show actually added to its character.
Yeah. I grew up loving the Our Gang comedies, Little Rascals. Mm-hmm. and what I love about them is that they have just sort of this this like homemade quality to all of them, not just their shows, but just the episodes themselves. Mm-hmm. And when I imagine Shuffle Along, that's kind of what it was like. You know, they on their opening night, they were $21,000 in debt. And that's $21,000 in 1921 money.
Right.
I mean, so, they really had a hard time of it. And in fact, one of the things that I think a lot of people don't necessarily realize about Shuffle Along, even if they're familiar with the show, is that it was put up so incredibly quickly. Mm-hmm. The two pairs sort of decided that they were going to work together in late January. And by March, they were already on the road with this show. Mm-hmm. And in May, they were in New York. So, you know, it wasn't just that they had no money for costumes. You know, everything was a hand-me-down. They were up on 63rd Street, even though, you know, the ticket price qualified it as Broadway, and also the size of the house, but it was a renovated lecture hall. It was actually still being worked on literally during its very first performance. The opening night reviews of the show, actually it's not the opening night, it was the preview night reviews of the show, commented that you could still hear the sounds of people working that scene, you know? But something about that, I think, you know, it kind of reminds me of the best aspects of community theater, where you don't necessarily need a great set, you don't necessarily need great costumes, but if you have great performers and you're just doing a great piece of theater, all of those other things that you're missing kind of fade away. Mm-hmm. In a, you know, your eye kind of learns to look beyond those things.
Right. It's the magic of live theater.
Yeah, it is.
That's what it is. It's the imagination of the audience is required.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and I think the material in Shuffle Along is so incredibly strong. And I think the way that they structured the show, you know, it's a two-act musical, but they kind of get the second act out of the way within about 25 minutes. And then Sissel and Blake would get up on stage and they would play a concert, you know, for the last 20 minutes. You know, so
which the listeners have to understand, in the early 20s and all through the 1920s, this wasn't that unusual, because even as we most of us know, if you know theater history at all, the shows in the 20s and all the way into the 30s had the flimsiest of books. I mean, it really was an excuse to string, you know, songs together. I mean, there was a plot. I mean, the show was originally called The Mayor of Jimtown before it became Shuffle Along. And it does have a kind of a political satire story to it, which is in itself really interesting. But it really was an excuse to do musical numbers and dance numbers and ultimately have, you know, have Miller and Lyles do their comedy shtick and have, you know, Sissel and Blake do their songs. So, you know, this wasn't odd, but they'd all pulled together.
And I think that's what's so interesting about this show, is that it really was kind of a party every night. And, you know, so much so that they ultimately added a midnight, you know, matinee performance on Wednesday night so that other performers on Broadway could go see the show. And, you know, when you talk about it being kind of tucked away on 63rd Street, what ends up happening is after these performances of Shuffle Along, a lot of white theater goers would then just continue uptown and make their way to Harlem and continue the party there and go to the speakeasies there. I mean, this was the very beginning of the Prohibition era. So, I mean, New York in and of itself was important to establish as a character in this book too.
Right.
You had the sort of beginnings of Harlem as a Black enclave, not the very beginnings in the 20s, but only, you know, less than a decade away from it really kind of being what Harlem has become. You have a lot of theaters had been closed because of the Spanish flu pandemic. You had an economy that was completely decimated because of World War One and also Prohibition. You had the rise of the flapper, you know, as just a female empowerment figure. And also, it's a kind of a minor note in the book, but I feel like it's kind of significant. You know, you had a rise also in divorce rates. So because when men went overseas for the First World War, women joined the workforce. And when their men came back home and tried to sort of put them in their place, some of the women, you know, didn't want to be put back in their place for every good reason. And so you had New York was changing. It was a changing New York. And also, it's important to note that this was also the greatest period of racialized violence in this country since the Civil War.
Right. And you touch on that very directly in the book, which I thought was really interesting, that despite everything that's going on in New York, with, and I mean, we're not even going to go into detail on it, but you talk in great depth about the whole nightclub scene and, you know, the beginnings of all these fantastic nightclubs in New York. And you have all of this going on where there's Black performers and the beginnings of jazz. And as you said, the Harlem Renaissance, but in other parts of the country, you still have lynchings going on. It's, yeah. You know, it's a very odd contrast between everything.
Yeah. But the 1 week after Shuffle opened on Broadway, the Tulsa Race Massacre occurred.
Right. Yeah.
No, it's just that the juxtaposition of those two things is staggering. And, you know, Noble Sissel actually said he felt like part of the reason why Shuffle Along caught on so much with the Black community was because people just wanted some joy. Mm-hmm. You know, it became, you know, good news on the front page as opposed to, right. You know, the same bad headlines over mm-hmm. and over. And I think that's a really interesting way of looking at this moment, but I think it's also a really interesting way of looking at the power of art, especially in our current post George Floyd moment as well.
Mm-hmm. And not only was it so significant for Black audiences in New York, but in some ways, just as important was the success with white audiences. I mean, because the whole belief was that white audiences would not come to a show like this, not in the numbers that they did. I mean, it became a huge success with white audiences because it was such an entertaining evening. It was so much fun and it was such a great show that white audiences and Black audiences were flocking to the show, which was odd for, I mean, that just did not happen in New York.
No, it was impossible to deny it. I think, you know, it's important also to note that the thought was that white audiences wouldn't pay these prices.
Mm-hmm.
Also, that white audiences would not accept the romantic subplot
mm-hmm. that
Shuffle Along. And so, you know, it's funny because I had the opportunity to speak about this book quite a bit. You know, we talked about the fact that this is a re-release. And people are always so flummoxed about, well, what was it about this romantic subplot? You know, was it between a Black man and a white woman?
No, it was just the fact that it was a Black romance on stage.
That's it. That's all it was.
Because Black characters and white audiences were not used to seeing Black characters have real relationships on stage.
Real emotions, real
right, exactly.
Real friendships, real marriages, you know, just it's kind of unbelievable.
Come dear and don't let our faith weaken. Let's keep our love light shining bright. Your love for me is a heavenly beacon, guiding me on through love's darkest night. Don't start minding or fault finding, no matter how dark the path may grow. Fate won't hurry, well, don't worry. Just to keep our hearts aglow, our love will find a way. Though the skies are gray, love like ours can never be ruled. Cupid's not schooled that way. Dry each tear, dimmed eye, clouds will soon roll by. Though fate may lead us astray, my dear, mark what I say. Lord,
heart's cool that way. Dry each tear-dimmed eye, clouds will soon roll by. Though fate may lead us astray, my dearie, mark what I say. Love will find a way.
Shuffle along, you know. I feel like it's so important to say, to acknowledge that, yes, there are problematic aspects to the show. But also, this show for 1921, was incredibly progressive in a lot of ways. You had a suffragette character in this show, you know, a year after women had gained the right to vote. And when we say women got the right to vote, primarily we're talking about white women having the actual franchise. You had, a ragtime score. You had a political satire in an all-black show that ultimately toured the country, including the Deep South. And this is obviously taking place 30, 40 years before Selma, where people were still fighting for the right to vote, and yet you have this political satire where three black men are competing to be the mayor of this, you know, fictional town. It's kind of remarkable. And so I do feel like it's, you know, I always feel like I need to be an ambassador for the book of the show, because while it is certainly a vehicle to kind of get to the next song, I think what they packed in to the thin script that they had is really interesting, and really interesting to look at, especially from the lens, from a 1921 lens.
I totally agree. Because when I read the kind of the synopsis that you provide throughout the story of what the book for Shuffle Along contained, even I was surprised, because I was like, most of these shows were, you know, boy meets girl, and, you know, girl's parents are rich and they think he's poor and he has to win them over. I mean, they're really simplistic plots. And I was reading this going, this is sort of like really interesting, pointed satire that's really hitting on a lot of things that I know is being presented in a light, fun package, but it is definitely tackling things that I don't think were being tackled in the 1920s. In musicals. So, but I want to talk a little bit, backtracking a little bit, I want to talk a little bit about the casting of the show, because there were some, obviously we have names that became very famous, like Alberta Hunter and Josephine Baker, who had auditioned for the show but were turned down for interesting reasons. And I want to kind of go into that, because I thought that was a really interesting aspect, was the fact that there was this perception, whether I don't know if it's necessarily stated historically, but they were looking in terms of casting the women, the girls in the chorus, because it was, you know, a 1920 show always had chorus girls, and they had a very large chorus of women, but they were looking for light-skinned blacks. And they were not, if you were too dark, you would not get cast. So talk a little bit about that, because it was sort of really odd to read that and think to yourself, what was the, especially because it's a show that's also got blackface in it. It's sort of there's all these racial dynamics going on just in even the casting and the makeup of the show.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one of the things that's sort of interesting is Claude McKay wrote a really interesting piece. And I have to say, you know, researching this book was a trip. And this was something that I found so late in my research process, this article by, or this editorial by Claude McKay. I was over the moon when I found it, because it was really a celebration of Shuffle Along, but also kind of a plea. It wasn't even an indictment. It was really just a request to show greater diversity of the skin tones of Black women because white audiences needed to see it. It was certainly no secret to Black audiences, and you know, Black people who were interested in women knew that there were women that were beautiful in all different skin tones. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't being presented to white audiences. And Noble Sissle really was the main person behind that decision. And, you know, I mentioned before that he was, you know, the more business-oriented person. And his thought process was, we have to compete with Florence Ziegfeld. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to compete with white chorus girls. And so the best way to do that and the best way to be sort of non-threatening and accepting to white audiences is to have fair-skinned Black women on stage. But he received a lot of criticism for that. He received a lot of criticism within the Black community. In a strange sort of way, there was almost, I think, more criticism for that decision than even Black performers in blackface.
Right, exactly.
Because the blackface was just a convention of the day. You know, it was not, don't get me wrong, it wasn't that people liked the convention, but people understood that it was the convention. Mm-hmm. While with Shuffle Along, because it was introducing Black women to the stage in this new way, the thought was, my goodness, don't create parameters, you know, with this show. You know, just go for it. But, you know, we'll never really know, I suppose, whether or not the show would have been hindered in some way with white audiences had that casting decision not been made. But it certainly did lead to, you know, I'm looking at the book cover right now, and I think I see one person on the cover, one woman on the cover who maybe has a little bit of a darker skin tone, but pretty much everyone, you know, in the right lighting and the right conditions could almost pass for white in terms of their skin tone. So Josephine Baker, of all people,
right,
was considered too dark for Shuffle Along initially. And through a really interesting ways that I won't spoil, she manages to, after two failed auditions, she manages somehow to wiggle her way into the show and also kind of steal the show in the process.
Right. And it really helped launch her career, which would go on to huge success when she moved to Paris, which I want to talk about in a second.
Decent career, I think
yeah, pretty decent career, considering that you mentioned Josephine Baker and pretty much everybody knows who that is. I don't want to diminish the women who did become stars in the show, because mm-hmm. you know, you've got Lottie G and Gertrude Saunders, who mm-hmm. was then replaced by Florence Mills, who in herself became a huge star. And they may be forgotten names to us now, but at the time, these three women all were stars. And they were stars almost exclusively because of Shuffle Along. I mean, that and the fact that they recorded songs from the show made them stars, and made them stars who then could like be demanding of higher salaries and demanding of better conditions and leave the show because they got better offers elsewhere because they became in demand. But it was just really interesting to me to not only see the people who were not cast in the show, who later went on to become successful, but also the fact that there's a lot of people who were in the show who became stars that we may not remember to this day, but who really did have an impact.
And I wanted to kind of live in the space of Florence Mills for a moment, because, you know, everyone knows Josephine Baker, as we've said, but Florence right. Mills actually was to England what Josephine Baker was to Paris.
Right.
And she was... It's impossible to, I mean, Lottie G was a huge star, like a massive star. Gertrude Saunders, massive star. But Florence Mills was a supernova mm-hmm. in the mid-1920s. What's amazing, the one thing I want to kind of correct is Florence Mills actually never had her voice recorded ever. You know, she's the one. And it's kind of astonishing that she was the biggest celebrity of all of them, so celebrated as a vocalist, and also not just as a singer, but So many reviews and write-ups about the way that she interpreted songs, that she was really a performer and someone who sang with her whole soul. And there is no way to hear her. It's staggering, actually. It haunts me, to be honest with you. It really right. does. It haunts me a little bit. But no, they are wonderful people. And also, you know, I think when you look down the list of the Quarines from Shuffle Along, even the ones that weren't breakout stars, they kind of all went on to do things. You know, and that's really what's amazing. Some of them, you know, Elida Webb went on to be a choreographer, you know, black woman choreographer on Broadway. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're just all of these. Freddie Washington.
I was going to bring up Freddie Washington, who went to Hollywood and did movies.
Yeah,
and was a wonderful actress. And fortunately, because she did the original Imitation of Life with Claudette Colbert and Louise Beavers. Was that right? Yeah, and she played the daughter who is sort of passing for white, and she was actually kind of took a lot of criticism because people thought she might actually really be white. I mean, which was, and her career unfortunately just never went as far as it could have in Hollywood, but she was a fascinating person.
Yeah. And it was, you know, look, for me, it was very obvious that just by the nature of the show, there were going to be men at the center of the narrative. Mm-hmm. And I really was determined to try and pull out as much as I could in a way, you know, as without stopping the narrative dead in its tracks, hopefully. I really wanted to make as much space as possible for as many women because the women were so integral to the success of the show.
Right.
You know, they didn't write, but you know, even the dancing, you know, the choreography was kind of done collectively, actually. Like there was a choreographer who ultimately called balls and strikes and had, you know, veto power and made the ultimate decisions. But a lot of the choreography of this show came out of the women doing things that felt good to their feet, their bodies, their heads, when they heard the music, and bringing in moves that they had just done in their families with their friends and putting it all together. And so I did not want to tell this story without highlighting some key women in the cast and not just talking about their importance to the show, but also giving a little bit of their biography in the same way that the men had their biography sort of spelled out.
Right. Well, and I think they're just as important, not only because, I mean, even if you didn't, no matter how good, how well written the show is or how great the score is of a show, if you don't have the performers to sell it on stage and appeal to the audience, it's not going to be a hit. And the fact that these were such unique women performers, black women performers, makes this so important to focus on them. And I think one of the other things that I really found intriguing, which kind of melds something we talked about a little bit earlier, which was not the success of someone like Florence Mills and what a big star she became in England. And Josephine Baker became such a huge star in France. But then also go back to, you know, the James Reese Europe performances and touring around Europe the book really emphasizes the total dichotomy between the acceptance of black performers in Europe versus the acceptance of black performers in America at the time, and how it was just two different worlds.
And it's funny because one of the I mentioned that we lost about, you know, 15 or so pages in the book, and there's a chapter where I think the entire chapter is in France. And I just fell in love with James Reese Europe. I fell in love with black people abroad, as I put it, in this book. And that chapter is probably where the deepest cuts were made, because right. that chapter just went a little bit longer. And my editor said, you know, we have to get back to American Jew. Eventually, we promise people shuffle along. We can't right. hit page 200, you know, without getting to shuffle along.
Well, I'm glad you did, because everybody knows the Josephine Baker story, and everyone knows that, you know, audiences in France were so accepting of her as a Black performer and didn't even see the color of her skin. She was just a fantastic performer. But your book points out that it wasn't just Josephine Baker. It was a lot of Black performers found huge success in Europe. And it was because audiences over there were basically colorblind.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And America, it was the opposite.
Yeah. I mean, it was almost more, even more insidious than that, where, like, I think there was something about Black people abroad that was novel and distinctly American. And I think they just really appreciated Black artistry, you know, mm-hmm. all of those things that we were talking about before with James Reese Europe saying, embrace your culture, embrace the way that you dance, embrace the way that you sing, embrace, you know, don't try and imitate white people. European audiences just got it. You know, they appreciated that. And in a sad way, you know, in certain parts of America, including certain parts of New York City, it was almost like if you were a really talented Black person, people were like, no, go away. Like, you're almost too good. You know, there's, I tell the story of Ziegfeld's Follies of 1922, where Gilda Gray sings a song, It's Getting Dark on Old Broadway, and performs this kind of grotesque number where it's really making fun of and taking issue with the rise of Black performers that are now on the Great White Way. Mm-hmm. Not named because of race, certainly, but, you know, the name, you know, if the shoe fits, I suppose.
Right.
And so at the same time that you have this kind of criticism and co-opting of certain elements from Black musicals in white shows and kind of passing them off as being original, in Europe you just have this great celebration and embracing and exalting of Black performers, and that to me, I think, was significant, like you said.
And I want to talk a little bit about after Shuffle Along obviously finishes its run, and even I think even while it was still running towards the end of its run, it goes on a very successful tour where it proves everybody wrong and that it can play to white audiences everywhere. Mm-hmm. But obviously that kind of success then breeds imitators and other attempts to kind of recreate the success of Shuffle Along. The only one of which would be kind of Runnin' Wild, which is the show that Miller and Lyles did. Even though it didn't necessarily run as long as Shuffle Along, it did have some success, although you kind of get the impression that the success wasn't going to last much longer for them, just because the whole concept of Black performers performing in blackface was becoming less acceptable. And just you can see the societal interests are changing, even for Black performers. And you can kind of see that the end is in sight for Miller and Lyles, because they can't keep perpetuating the stereotypes and the blackface for much longer, because it's just not going to be acceptable anymore. But one of the things I found, one of the sections I really found so interesting, was the section on the Chocolate Dandies, because that's the big musical that Ubi Blake and Noble Sissle did next, or did, you know, to try and get to a big Broadway show. This was a big budget Broadway show.
A huge budget.
And the response to the show is just, to me, so, it's like a punch to the stomach when you read the reactions, because they're now back on Broadway doing a big budget show, and they're being criticized for being too white. they're like aspiring to be too white, And not only in the show's production values, because it doesn't look, you know, ragtag and pulled together like Shuffle Along did.
I think there were three live horses that were a part of the cast.
Right. I mean, this was a big budget show with great costumes and sets and the whole bit. And I want to quote one critic who, and I'm sure you know which quote I'm going to say, because you quote one critic who wrote, "It was too much art and not enough Africa," which was just jaw-dropping to read, because as you say, and I'm going to quote you from the book, because I think your comment really rings true, which was, "Black performers were damned if they attempted to conform to the conventional standards of Broadway and damned if they didn't." Mm-hmm. So it's talk a little bit about that, because it's especially talk about, because I love how you talk about the Dixie Moon number and how they're recreating this kind of Old South number using Black performers. And the audience is like really enjoying the show until one specific moment in that number. So talk about the whole concept of, it's okay if you're doing Shuffle Along and it's very Black and it's very jazz score and it's very low budget, but as soon as you try and aspire to really fit in and conform to the Broadway standards, you're trying to be white, and we don't want you to be white. We want you to be Black. So talk a little bit about that. It was just, that whole section was to me just amazing to read.
Yeah. And it was amazing for me to discover, because hopefully like readers, hopefully like when you were going through the book, you sort of feel the writing on the wall.
Yeah.
But you also hope, well, maybe before we get to the writing, maybe there will be some more successes. And it just doesn't really pan out after Shuffle Along. It's not all doom and gloom. It's not, you know, it's not that the last, you know, 150 pages or so are a dumpster fire, but
no.
They're just what became apparent was that Shuffle Along worked for a couple of reasons. It was this sort of mixing of uptown and downtown. It was this sort of blending of tuxedoed Blacks and also, Blackface comedians. And there was something for your liberal intelligentsia, and there was something for, the everyday folk or people, you know, or perhaps even, you know, worse, you know, people that really did enjoy racial humor, and that's what they went to the theater for. It's what enabled this show to tour South Carolina and Tennessee and Georgia. And, you know, there's another critic who says something, I'm paraphrasing, but says something to the effect of, you know, if we wanted to see an all-white show, or we wanted to see a white show, why would we pay to see Black people do it? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm paraphrasing, but that's basically the sentiment. And I think that in a lot of ways, that aspect of not really knowing how to best gain acceptance from certain sects of the white population is still very much so a 2023 problem as well. Mm-hmm. When you look at, and this is written about in the book, you know, part of the reason why Black men enlisted in the First World War was because you had people like Du Bois arguing that if you enlist and go overseas, when you come back, America certainly will have to recognize your full citizenship. And what happened was, when Black soldiers came back and would walk around in their uniforms, very often they were met with violence. Mm-hmm. I write in the book a little bit about the Tulsa Race Massacre, just in terms of its proximity to Shuffle Along's opening, and someone's quoted in that section of the book as saying, while the massacre itself was kind of unexpected, for people who were from Tulsa, you could see it sort of brimming in the air after the First World War, because Black men no longer gave up their seat to white men. Mm-hmm. They no longer, you know, stepped aside on the sidewalk. And there were lots of white people that did not take kindly to that. And so, you know, the Chocolate Dandies was interesting because it was a big budget show. It was on Broadway proper. They did everything that they wish they could have done with Shuffle. They cashed in and reinvested, you know, mm-hmm. in themselves. And white audiences, by and large, just didn't bite.
Like I said, that section just was, it was just sad, yeah. You know, because you've got an obviously very talented songwriting team behind this. And I think you even quote UB Blake in there saying that it's like one of his favorite scores that he ever wrote.
It's the best thing he's ever written was the score to that show.
Yeah. And because they were trying to quote unquote assimilate into the Broadway, you know, community, they weren't accepted. And they weren't accepted because they were Black. And that was just all there was to it.
I think one of the things too that I think is worth mentioning is it reminds me that, you know, for so many Black people in America, there's no way to divorce, you know, I guess I'll say quote unquote white art, you know, if I'm being really simplistic and reductive about it, from just your cultural experience, you know, mm-hmm. like we have, you know, everyone knows Star Wars and Titanic and Back to the Future. And, you know, these are just things that are part of the American DNA. But if you are white in America, you can sort of self-select and not engage with certain aspects of Black culture that even if it is incredibly popular, you know, mm-hmm. you can sort of remove yourself from it. And so I say all this to say, you know, UB Blake, as I said before, was a lover of European composers. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't that they just sat back and said, okay, here's how to write a white show. You know, right. they were writing what they believed to be a proper Broadway musical. And the accusation was that they were trying to copy white people as opposed to just making a good piece of art for the genre.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And the like you said, the last, you know, section of the book is not doom and gloom, although, you know, their careers, things, none of the four original creators were really left financially stable because of the success of the show. Mostly, I mean, because they reinvested and they, you know, they put money into new projects and they would, you know, end up losing money. Fortunately, you know, Sissel and Blake had a bit of resurgence in the 1940s, thanks to Harry Truman using I'm Just Wild About Harry for his 1948 presidential campaign, which kind of brought the song back into public consciousness. And then, of course, later on, you've got the show Bubbling Brown Sugar, which features songs from this from that era, including some of their songs. And then, of course, you've got the big Broadway show Ubi, which is all about Ubi Blake. And I am old enough to remember, because I am substantially older than you, but I'm old enough to remember when I was a kid seeing Ubi Blake on TV all the time. Mm-hmm. He was on every variety show and talk show talking about his career, playing, like you said, playing the piano right up until his final days, and entertaining. And so, you know, that's why Ubi Blake kind of is in my consciousness, because even as a kid, I remember seeing him on TV telling his stories. But one of the things I thought was interesting is you had access to the correspondence between August Wilson and Jack Fertel when, because Jack Fertel was one of the founders of the Encores at City Center in New York, which we all know now, but they were considering Shuffle Along. And he consulted with August Wilson, the obviously famous playwright, in terms of whether he thought Shuffle Along was revivable, even if just in a concert setting. And it was just kind of a fascinating read to hear Wilson's take on it. And, you know, so the question I have for you, after you've now gone through this whole immersion into the world of Shuffle Along, is Shuffle Along revivable? Because, you know, the George Wolf show wasn't really a revival of Shuffle Along. It used the songs from Shuffle Along, but it was telling the story of the making of the show, as opposed to actually doing the show. But I, you know, we revive other shows of the period that have problematic issues with either women, the way they treat women, or the racial components, and we revive them, but we revive them providing some context in terms of the historical place they hold. But is Shuffle Along revivable? That's the question for you.
That's the question, isn't it?
And you don't know. I mean, you may not have an answer.
I mean, but
it's such a fantastic. And I mean, I think one of the saddest things is that we have a recording, fortunately, of Ubi Blake and Noble Sissel performing songs from Shuffle Along, and that's, you know, people, listeners will have heard several selections during the show. But there was never a cast recording of the songs from Shuffle Along from the Broadway production. Although we will be hearing some things, because we do have the sampler track, that sampler album that was sent to the Tony voters. So we have some of those things. But, you know, it's sad that the show had been forgotten for so long, because it is such a landmark musical in American theater, and also a landmark vehicle in Black art, in Black entertainment. So how do we look at Shuffle Along now in terms of what is its legacy, and how can it be really looked at anymore?
I feel like I want to live in a world where Shuffle Along is revivable.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if we do live in that world.
Right.
And I, you know, in the book, I sort of explicitly ask the reader that question as well, because it's something that I grappled with as I was researching, as I was writing, as I was going on this emotional roller coaster, as I found myself wondering, how in the world can I, how do I have to make cuts to a book that ultimately was going to be 400 pages about a musical that so few people know about, even though in 2016, there was an iteration of that musical on stage. And even still, there are people that don't know about Shuffle Along's existence. How is it possible that there can be a book of this size and of this depth, if I can say that, about something that so few people know about? I think the question that makes me saddest that people ask me all the time is, well, like, how did you find all of this information? And that's different than like, tell me about your research process, but how did you find it? I think almost implies that I had to search really hard. And the sad thing is, once you sort of started looking in the right places, everything was there. Mm-hmm. It would be like if someone 100 years from now wrote a book about Hamilton. Mm-hmm. You know, you wouldn't need to dig things up. Everything would be there waiting for you. Mm-hmm. And it's just been waiting for 100 years.
Right.
You know, and I think we really do have to, I think there are elements of Shuffle Along that can be revived. I think that obviously there are no notes in the script about characters in blackface. It's not like that needs to be done or anything like that, of course, obviously. I think a lot of the humor holds up, and I think that you could just divorce it from dialectical speech, you know, like that sort of thing. Because there are all sorts of problematic shows. There are shows that have horrible depictions of blacks and Asians and women and members of the LGBTQIA+ community. There are shows that continue to be staged that I wonder how in the world is this being staged, because I think they have horrible depictions of portions of the population in the 21st century. Mm-hmm. Yet Shuffle Along is considered not really revivable. And so, right. You know, that's why whenever I sort of have the opportunity, I try, and whether it's, you know, I love that in this podcast, people have been able to hear the sounds of the show. In May, on May 22nd, actually, I'm going to be producing a concert of Shuffle Along at 54 Below. And I'm excited that we're going to be doing almost the entire score of the show at that performance. And the music holds up, you know, better than the book, as with
almost any show from that period.
Every show. But I do hope that people use When Broadway Was Black as an entry point to actually go and engage with the original 1921 production. Mm-hmm. It's looking up the libretto, whether it's listening to the score. I hope that people, beyond just being interested in the story, really go back and engage with the actual work of Cecil Blake, Miller and Lyles, because in that small way, it helps their work to continue to live on.
I totally agree. And I think, you know, one of the problems that we always have when we discuss American musical theater history is we have these blind spots, and there's this always been this blind spot of, well, you know, the only American musical theater history kind of begins with Showboat, because mm-hmm. anything before that people just kind of discount as frivolous, you know, nonsense, even though there's like great stuff from Rodgers and Hart and the Gershwins and Shuffle Along and all these wonderful things with songs that we know because they become standards. Mm-hmm. But Showboat is like the marker where everybody starts. And then you move into the 1930s and you might talk a little bit about Anything Goes, mm-hmm. but then you don't talk about anything until Oklahoma. And it's sort of like, and then we suddenly talk about the golden age. And what I like about your book is not only is it focusing and shining a spotlight on Shuffle Along, but I'm hoping it will direct people's attention to the other golden age of musical theater, which is what was going on in the early beginnings of musical theater, looking at the 20s, looking at the early 30s, and really looking at shows like Shuffle Along that were making an impact and were important landmark productions that we should be remembering. It didn't just start with Showboat. There was a lot before that.
And I love that you said that, because in some ways I sort of felt as I was writing it almost like I was disrupting just conventional musical theater history, you know, in some way by acknowledging that there was this beautiful period between 1921 and 1927, 1929 of shows. And again, that's not to say that they were all winners, you know?
No,
but not everything's a winner on Broadway, you know?
God, no. And but all the things that were being done and all the creative choices that were being made in the early 1920s are what leads to something like Showboat and what leads to the great musical comedies of the 1930s. And it's all, you've got to go from the formative years through, you know, through all those steps. And if you just start with Showboat, you are missing a big chunk of wonderful history. So, and that's what your book helps with.
And I think that that's, for me, I love that that's why I feel like the book ultimately is triumphant, you know, not only because Shuffle Along happens and is a huge success, but, you know, despite the fact that the Four Men at the center of it were unable to recapture that magic, you can't deny that what they achieved in 1921 continued to reverberate. And I think, you know, going back to a point that you were making earlier, I think it's sort of fascinating and frustrating that they were so innovative in 1921. And I think part of what sort of, you know, did them in, quote unquote, professionally was that they were unable to innovate. You know, you see them kind of getting stuck in amber, and musical theater and just society, you know, American society passing them by.
Right.
And, you know, they just are unable to adapt. And you see that a lot. That's not unique to the four of them. You see that, you know, in life in a lot of ways, but it's so frustrating because there's just so much talent there, and you just wish that they had been able to they'd been able to adapt along with society in ways that they just were unable to.
Well, Cassine, I'm so glad you came on the show. I love the book. I thought it was a wonderful read. And as I said at the beginning, I could not put it down. So, you know, in between, you know, touring the pyramids and going down the Nile on a cruise, I was glued to the book. So congratulations. Listeners, the book will be out on the 7th, which is this coming Tuesday. And Cassine will be at the Museum of Broadway on the 8th. What time are you going to be there?
6 to 7,
signing the book. So you can
book. I'll be in conversation with John McWhorter of the wonderful author and at the New York Times. And then we'll be talking, we'll be answering questions, and then I'll be signing books.
And I will include some links here on the website so that people can find not only you, but also find the book. We'll provide a couple of different links so people have some options as to where they want to get it. But they can get signed copies from you, correct? If they go to whenbroadwaywasblack.com, right?
That's right.
So I will include that link because I don't have a signed copy. I wish I had a signed copy. I have a copy that came from the publicist, but it was not signed.
I can make that happen for you.
I would appreciate it because I really want to. This is an important book to add to your theater library. It just is. It's an important book. So congratulations again. And I'm so thrilled you were able to come on the show.
Thank you. It's my honor. Thank you.
Moonlighting from her hit downtown show, let's give an uptown shout to the biggest sepia sensation on Broadway, Miss Lottie G. Come on,
yeah,
y'all.
Come on!